The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Systemic allergic disorders, immunodeficiency, and immunoglobulin disorders is presented by Dr. Brian Martin.
So what's our real objective of being here and suffering through a day like today? It's to pass the boards, right? What I want to do in the next 30 minutes is to categorize primary immunodeficiency. We're going to kind of use all that information we got in the last half hours. We'll look at the results of presenting symptoms and testing. We want to talk a little bit about oral allergy, recognize and advise patients with food allergies, and look at some folks with allergic reactions to medications. So when we look at primary immunodeficiencies, these have been recognized since 1952. And there are over 200 genetically determined immunodeficiency diseases that are recognized, but we're not going to look at 200 diseases. The problem is that the patient usually looks overtly normal. So when there's a visible abnormality, it's a test question. So we want to look at some of those. We talked about the innate and the specific immune system. We talked about the immune system components, the complement, and its critical role against bacteria, fungal infections, and viruses, and the role of phagocytic cells. We talked about the immune system and the lymphocytes' role in specificity and in recognition. And what happens is, in each of those areas we discussed, we can have a primary immunodeficiency. So this shows relative frequency of different types of primary immunodeficiencies. And I'm going to come back to this slide a number of times. So when we look at a patient and we think we're looking at a patient with a primary immunodeficiency, we have to think about what features are associated with specific immunodeficiency disorders. So in the patient that has recurrent otitis media and recurrent pneumonia, bacterial infections, we know that the humoral response is what's important for bacteria, so we want to look for hypogammaglobulinemia on the patient who has recurrent bacterial infections. On the other hand, if it's a fungal infection, protozoal infection, or viral infection, then we have to worry about defective cell-mediated immunity. And if we have an uncommon bacteria, one that's typically of low virulence but is infecting our patient, we have to think about chronic granulomatous disease. So when we look at the different kinds of immunodeficiencies, we'll start with complement deficiencies. We've already talked about complement's critical role. We know that it's important in early stage of infection and that it helps us clear infection from the bloodstream. When we look at complement deficiencies, we can divide deficiencies into early components or late components. C3 deficiency is an early component deficiency. We know it's an opsonic ligand, and if we have a C3 deficiency, we have increased susceptibility to bacteria for which opsonization is a primary defense mechanism. So with strep pneumoniae or Haemophilus, we have to think about a C3 deficiency. We can also have C1, C4, C2 deficiencies as part of our early component deficiency. These will be similar to C3 deficiencies, but because we know that C3 is where all of our three different pathways come together, it only makes sense that a C3 deficiency would be the most serious of our complement deficiencies. So if we have other deficiencies in the early components that they're not as susceptible to disease as those with C3 deficiency. I don't think this will be a test question. I'll still throw it out there. The most common early component deficiency is a C2 deficiency. Terminal component deficiencies are the other big, broad area of complement deficiency, so it's C5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And so essentially, without C5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, we can't assemble the membrane attack complex, or the MAC. So only gram-negative bacteria who are susceptible to the bactericidal components of the MAC attack complex are affected. So these patients are susceptible to gram-negative bacteria such as Neisseria meningitidis. And if you see a patient who is infected with Neisseria, start to look for an underlying late component or complement deficiency. That's a long-standing favorite board question. So that's it for complement deficiencies. We'll move now to phagocytic problems. When we look at phagocytic disorders, they fall into three categories. Neutropenia, not enough phagocytes. LAD, leukocyte adhesion deficiency, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, but importantly, we have lots and lots of stupid leukocytes. We've got a lot of them that can't get where they need to go. And then disorders of microbicidal activity. We have enough of our phagocytes. They're smart enough to get to where they need to be, but when they get there, they don't work. The three different kinds of phagocytic disorder. One area that you may have questions is on LAD, or leukocyte adhesion deficiency. So this is an order of a disorder of migration and or adhesion. We've already talked about what that means. What we see in the patient is extreme leukocytosis. We have 15 to 70,000 white count consistently and can climb to over 100,000 with infection. So there's an abnormal inflammatory response, recurrent bacterial infections, and this whole delayed separation of the umbilical cord I would ignore, frankly, because it's just too nonspecific. LAD comes in three different flavors. So LAD1, we lack the leukocyte integrin CD11, CD18 complex. So the cell surface of our leukocyte doesn't have its cellular adhesion molecules. And this can be partial or complete. LAD2, our leukocytes are okay. They have the appropriate cell adhesion molecule, but our vascular endothelium doesn't have the appropriate cellular adhesion molecules. And so in both cases, no matter whether it's the leukocyte that's missing the adhesion molecules or our vascular endothelium that doesn't have the adhesion molecules, in either case, our neutrophils, all of our phagocytes just go zipping on by, and they ignore the call to go into an area of inflammation. And LAD3 I'm fairly sure LAD3 is not going to be tested. We're still talking about LAD3, but it affects the beta 1, 2, and 3 integrin families, and it affects both the leukocytes and platelets. So we have LAD and bleeding disorders. That's LAD3. So we move now to phagocytic dysfunction. So our phagocytes don't work right. They're smart enough to get to where they need to go, but they can't do what they're supposed to do. And we see this in four big areas: CGD, or chronic granulomatous disease, C6PD deficiency, or Chediakagashi syndrome, and Jobes syndrome. And so when we have a phagocytic cell that doesn't work well, we have mild skin infections to severe systemic infections, but the clue, your test clue, is susceptibility to bacteria that are considered to be not very virulent. And these patients can have skin infections all the way up to organ abscesses. So most cases of chronic granulomatous disease are X-linked, and essentially this is an area that we're working on. There is an autosomal recessive type of a disease for CGD that's treated in the same way. And if we're going to try to diagnose a problem with our phagocytes, what we want to do first is, of course, get a leukocyte count with differential to see if we have too little or too many. and then to test whether or not our phagocytes work. In the old days, it was the nitroblue tetrazoleum test. If you see a test question revolving around NBT, it's going to be a color question. So a phagocyte that works takes yellow nitroblue tetrazoleum and reduces it to blue. I still have a scar because I missed that on my boards. So the modern test, it's not nitroblue tetrazoleum, but it's dihydrorhodamine. This is the test that we now use. And so dihydrorhodamine, we reduce dihydrorhodamine to rhodamine in normal cells. And so typically, if you are going to assess somebody for phagocytic disorders, you will order a dihydrorhodamine. So we can also have quantitative killing curve, superoxide generation. There are other tests that are used, but the clinical test of the day is DHR. Chediak Higashi is a potential board question because there is a specific photograph that you can see. Its characteristic abnormality are these giant cytoplasmic granular inclusions in leukocytes and platelets on routine peripheral smears. And so, I swear I have a picture later. I thought it was here. I apologize. But we'll see a picture of Chediak Higashi. The next one that we want to see is antibody dysfunctions or problem with antibody production. These are very common in terms of immunologic disorders, primary immunodeficiencies. And what we'll really see is common variable immunodeficiency. We should be aware of immunodeficiency with hyper-IgM, selective deficiencies of IgA, IgM, or IgG subclasses, and secondary problems that we can have a problem with low immunoglobulin numbers because we have to remember that our immunoglobulins are proteins, and if we have a protein-losing state, our immunoglobulin numbers will go down. So if we have a B-cell deficiency, we typically have recurrent high-grade bacterial infections, chronic sinopulmonary infections. This is not a problem with viral or fungal disorders. There's typically not growth failure in the kids. They survive well. They may or may not have palpable lymph nodes. Our test here is to get quantitative immunoglobulins, IgG, IgM, IgA. We can get isohemagglutinin titers to measure IgM antibody functioning. And the real way to look at this is to see whether or not patients can produce antibodies to a specific immunization. So we draw antibody levels, then we immunize the patient, we wait 4 to 6 weeks, redraw antibody levels, and we're looking for a fourfold increase in titer to say, yes, this patient, we've just tested that whole go-around that I showed last time. Can the patient recognize the antigen? Can the patient present the antigen? Can it be presented to a B-cell, and can the B-cell produce antibodies? So when we look at common variable immunodeficiency, it can be onset at any age. Usually symptomatic between 15 to 35, but there is no age range at which you can stop looking for common variable immunodeficiency. So again, recurrent pyogenic infections. These patients also have an increase in autoimmune disease. They have total Ig and IgG are low, but the B cell numbers are not. The B cell numbers are normal. So this is not a problem with our B cell numbers. It's a problem with our B cell function. And these patients can have normal lifespans. So our diagnostic test is the failure to produce antibody following specific immunization. And one of the things that I see a lot of is, what's a screening test? What's a diagnostic test? Diagnostic test for common variable immunodeficiency is an inability to produce antibody following a specific immunization. The major complications are chronic lung diseases that may occur whether or not we treat them. They have an increased prevalence of malignant diseases to include leukemias, lymphomas, and gastric carcinomas. And our treatment is 100 to 200 milligrams per kilogram of IVIG per month. A tricky one is this selective IgA deficiency. This is the most common immunodeficiency among Caucasians. And if you are given data that shows this patient has an IgA level of less than 5 milligrams per deciliter, you may be given that and say, and be faced with a number of therapeutic options. These patients can have increased allergies, they can have recurrent sinopulmonary infections, they can have GI tract disease, autoimmune diseases. But what we want to do with a patient who has a specific IgA deficiency is nothing. They may require additional or more frequent utilization of antibiotics, but we don't have an IgA replacement therapy, and these patients lead normal lives. They don't need specific IgA replacement therapy. Cellular immunodeficiency, the one we always think about is DeGeorge. It's probably not going to be on an internal medicine board, but on a pediatric board. The T-cell immunodeficiency disorder that you may very well see on an internal medicine board is chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis. And you'll see an image like you see here. Chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis is a selective T-cell deficit. Our B-cell immunity is still intact. It's essentially a hole in our T-cell armamentarium. So we have associated idiopathic endocrinopathies with hypoparathyroidism being most common. It can appear in the late second decade. And what we see are candidal infections of mucous membranes, or of the skin, or of the nails, or vaginal. It's usually not a systemic candidiasis. And these patients may live into the third decade, but this is a serious problem. And then we have our combined immunodeficiencies. And when we think about combined immunodeficiencies, we typically think about SCID. So the onset's frequently in infancy, they have recurrent infection, they have opportunistic infections, they don't thrive, they don't do well, they can have fatal reactions to live vaccine. But our T-cell immunity screening tests are lymphocyte counts. In children, or in babies, it's a chest x-ray for a thymus shadow, delayed skin type hypersensitivity, and quantitation of our T-cell subsets. But there are some places where we need to think about combined P and T-cell immunodeficiencies. And for adults, it's immunodeficiency with ataxia telangiectasia and Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome. So in immunodeficiency with ataxia telangiectasia, these patients may reach their fifth decade. They have a predisposition to malignancies. This is an autosomal recessive disease, but they have a progressive deterioration of their neurologic and their immunologic functions. They can have cerebellar ataxia. They have oculocutaneous telangiectasia. So boom, here is a photograph that will give away a diagnosis. So if you see a patient that has an immunodeficiency with a telangiectasia like this, or a history of progressive neurologic disorders, you need to think about ataxia with telangiectasia. And then Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome is another one that has a specific additive to it. And it's an immunodeficiency with thrombocytopenia, eczema, and recurrent infections. So this thrombocytopenia is characterized by small platelets, and we can identify this with the WASP gene. These patients have an increased incidence of lymphoid malignancies, and they typically have low IgM, high and elevated IgA and IgE. And then finally, one thing that sometimes shows up on test is graft versus host disease. And I think that what you need to understand for test questions in the time period that we have allotted is not so much the underlying physiology of graft versus host, but how do you recognize hyperacute, acute, and chronic graft versus host? So hyperacute is the macular papular rash with rapid progression. So this looks like TENS. It's associated with severe diarrhea, and these people typically die. Acute is a macular papular rash but it doesn't go on to look like TENS. They have diarrhea. They have time to develop hepatosplenomegaly. They have time to develop jaundice. They may develop cardiac arrhythmias, CNS irritabilities, and pulmonary infiltrates. And then chronic, you think of chronic desquamation of the skin, and you have dysplastic nail growth, and again, hepatosplenomegaly and chronic diarrhea. So we finally have ended immunology and immunodeficiencies. And let's go on to something else like anaphylaxis. Are you doing anaphylaxis too?
Oh, I thought so.
Tim and I have been together since we were fellows. He was a year ahead of me. We both did our fellowships in the military. He was at Walter Reed. I was out in Denver, Colorado. So if you see us play off against one another, it's only because we've been doing that for the last four decades. So I'm going to very quickly talk about anaphylaxis. And really all I want to say about anaphylaxis is underappreciated, and there has been a lot published on anaphylaxis recently. And I actually have a case that I put the answer right there. That's all right. So a 27-year-old known asthmatic presents to your office with acute onset of hives. He's complaining of shortness of breath and a racing heart after eating shrimp for lunch. He denies any known food allergy, and your response is one of these. This is how you're going to see the test question, because there are really a couple of questions here. One, do you recognize this as anaphylaxis? So they throw in these red herrings of his asthma, because the red herring of his asthma and wheezing is trying to make you go toward nebulized beta agonists and run down the asthma trail instead of recognize it as anaphylaxis and knowing that the treatment of anaphylaxis is IM epinephrine. In the old days, it was subcutaneous epinephrine. It is no longer subcutaneous epinephrine. It's IM epinephrine. And so, just very quickly, we all know about the Choosing Wisely program from the ABIM Foundation. And allergy immunology has put 10 things forward that physicians should and patients should know and question. And what fascinates me is five of them revolve in some way around anaphylaxis. Don't rely on antihistamines as first-line treatment in severe allergic reactions, anaphylaxis. Don't perform food IgE testing without a history consistent with potential IgE-mediated food allergy, food anaphylaxis. Don't routinely order low or iso-osmolar radiocontrast material or pre-treat with corticosteroids and antihistamines for patients with a history of seafood allergy who require radiocontrast media, anaphylaxis. Don't routinely avoid vaccination in egg allergic patients, concern about anaphylaxis. Don't overuse non-beta-lactam antibiotics in patients with a history of penicillin allergy without appropriate evaluation, anaphylaxis. So I'm going to skip over the definitions of anaphylaxis because I think Tim is going to hit on that. Okay. I'll stop at our clinical criteria and definition for anaphylaxis. So there was a concern among researchers that we didn't have an appropriate diagnosis for anaphylaxis. And they've come up with this clinical criteria for anaphylaxis, and they look at it in three different occasions. On the first occasion would be an unknown allergen and an acute onset of illness. They want to see skin and or mucosal involvement as hives or flushing and either respiratory involvement or cardiovascular involvement. The second scenario is after exposure to a likely allergen, rapid occurrence of at least two of the following: skin or mucosal involvement, respiratory compromise, cardiac compromise, or persistent GI symptoms. So skin, respiratory, cardiovascular, GI, or after exposure to a known allergen within minutes or hours developing a rapid occurrence of a drop in blood pressure. So our anaphylaxis signs and symptoms revolve around the skin with urticaria and angioedema, the respiratory tract with dyspnea and wheezing, the cardiovascular system with dizziness, syncope, hypotension, the GI tract with nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. We also see upper airway edema, headache, and we can see an involvement with the CNS with what people call a feeling of impending doom. And a favorite test question is to differentiate vasovagal reactions and anaphylaxis. So with vasovasal reactions, we typically see this with stress, so a very favorite question is that a patient's just been injected with something, and has a reaction. And you have to decide whether the reaction is a vasovagal reaction or is anaphylaxis. And so with the differential diagnosis of anaphylaxis and a vasovagal reaction, you look at those five systems. With the skin, you'll have urticaria and erythema with anaphylaxis, pale, clammy skin with vasovagal reactions. In the respiratory systems, you can have globus, shortness of breath, wheezing versus hyperventilation. So in anaphylaxis, your SpO2 should go down, and in vasovagal reactions, if anything, your SpO2 will go up. Cardiovascular tachycardia for anaphylaxis, bradycardia, and normotension. For vasovagal, GI, they both can have nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. And CNS, your anaphylactic patients can have a feeling of impending doom, whereas vasovagal patients will feel lightheaded. There are a number of new criteria for the treatment of anaphylaxis. I've taken this from the European guidelines. The reason I've taken it from the European guidelines is there's a lot of color on here, and I like what they've done with the first line therapy. If you look at the top black box, first line, you run across the only first line therapy for anaphylaxis is IM adrenaline or IM epinephrine. All these other things that the test question is going to try to get you to do, like giving the patient steroids, or giving the patient beta agonists, or giving the patient an antihistamine, those are all down here in the secondary things. The first line treatment of choice is IM epinephrine. Everything else is secondary. So the one thing that you should pay attention to is you want to be looking for the test patient, who is having anaphylaxis on beta blockers. If they ask you what the initial treatment is of a patient who is on beta blockers having anaphylaxis, it remains epinephrine. The one change in therapy, if the patient doesn't respond to multiple epinephrine injections, then we go to glucagon in the patient who is taking a beta blocker and anaphylaxing. And the reason is that patients on beta blockers, specifically non-specific beta blockers, have unusual severity. They have bradycardia and severe and sustained bronchospasm. You might have to differentiate between anaphylaxis and anaphylactoid reaction. Tim has already touched on this, that anaphylactoid reactions, and it's not going to be so simple as is this anaphylaxis or anaphylactoid reaction, but an anaphylactoid reaction looks like, smells like, is treated like anaphylaxis, but the mechanism of action is different. It's not IgE mediated and therefore doesn't need to have a previous exposure to have an anaphylactoid reaction. So we can see this with complement mediated problems, with direct activation of mast cell mediated diseases or mast cell mediated release. We can see it with arachidonic acid metabolism. So if we think about complement-mediated anaphylactoid reactions, we're looking at human plasma and blood products and dialysis membranes. For direct activation of mast cell mediators, opioids are the number one. But we can also see with vancomycin, with some of our muscle depolarizing drugs, aminoglycoside, and our radiocontrast media. Specifically with radiocontrast media, this is something that we just see in the hospital all the time. We know that we have an increased risk with IV administration of radiocontrast media that's high osmolality. Sensitization is not required, but we do know that previous reaction does mean you have a higher incidence of having a reaction on subsequent presentation, and that we can pre-treat patients to decrease their risk. Pre-treatment works well for anaphylactoid reaction, doesn't work as well for anaphylaxis that is IgE mediated. And then finally, we have modulators of arachidonic acid metabolism. Tim has already mentioned this, that this is typically with aspirin and non-steroidal drugs. They tend to progress a little bit more slowly, but the bronchoconstriction that you see with aspirin-sensitive patients can be profound. So we might have this differential diagnosis between anaphylaxis and vasovagal reactions. You may have questions that are going to focus on what's the underlying cause. And I have seen a series of questions or a series of mediators of anaphylactoid reactions with the question simply being, which of these are IgE mediated? So it's important to understand that there are ways to have anaphylaxis-like reactions that are not IgE-mediated, but mediated by one of these anaphylactoid methodologies. Thank you, and good luck on the exam.